This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Renee Rosen's books have taken place in Chicago in the 1950s, New York City in the 1960s, at Chess Records during the Civil Rights Movement, and in Chicago during Prohibition. In her newest novel, The Social Graces, we're back to New York City, and Newport, Rhode Island, and Paris, and wherever else Mrs. Vanderbilt and Mrs. Astor wish to travel as they vie for control of New York society during the Gilded Age. I recently spoke with Renee Rosen about the book, her research, and more. I'm Beth Goulet, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation.
I'm so pleased to have you back on Marginalia. We've gotten to know each other these last few years, and I'm realizing that I've read quite a few of your books, but I'm just so happy to have you on again. So would you mind giving us an overview of Social Graces?
Sure. So The Social Graces is based on the true story of two very powerful women, Alva Vanderbilt and Caroline Astor, battling for control of New York society during the Gilded Age. So we're talking like the 1870s to the early 1900s, and it's a time when women really didn't have any rights. You know, they didn't work outside the home. They didn't vote. They were beholden to their husbands or fathers. They didn't have their own money. But the one thing that they had was this world they called society. And it really sort of sprang up out of nowhere. And frankly, I think it's the reason they got up in the morning. You know, they had at least planning a 9-course dinner party gave them something to do. And, you know, of course, the more celebrated the hostess, the more powerful the woman. And back in that time period, no one was more powerful than Caroline Astor, or Mrs. Astor, as she preferred to be called. And she was the reigning queen of society. She was the gatekeeper. She determined who got in and who was left out in the cold. And her rival, Alva Vanderbilt, was younger. She was more aggressive, less conventional. And not only did she want in society, but she wanted to take over society. And this set up a very competitive rivalry between the two women, where they were competing at every turn for, you know, who could throw the biggest ball, who could wear more jewelry at one time, who could build the biggest mansion. And a bookseller friend said, oh my God, they're like the Real Housewives of New York City, but in ball gowns.
You're going to laugh because that is my question. I was about 2/3 of the way through the book and I put it down and said out loud, oh my word, except I probably said, oh my God, these are the original Real Housewives. I have that in
funny.
My questions. That's so funny.
That is funny.
So I want to talk about the structure of the book because it's broken down into like 4 time frames. And the chapters are told from the perspectives of these two women, either Caroline Astor or Alva Vanderbilt. And interspersed are chapters where we see everything through the lens of a, like the quote unquote society. And it felt like a Greek chorus. Talk to me about the structure.
So my first stab at the book, I tried to do it as a third person omniscient narrator. And that just was, everybody felt too distant from the characters. So then I backed up and I did it as a close third, which is Caroline's point of view and Alva's point of view. But it still felt like something was missing. And my fabulous editor and I were brainstorming and she suggested kind of floating in this chorus. And I felt like that kind of rounded out the narrative and conveyed just sensibilities and information that neither Alva or Caroline would be able to do. So that sort of Greek chorus, as you put it, is woven throughout the book.
So here is where I had written, oh my God, these are the original Real Housewives. You had seasons in New York and Paris and Newport. You had balls and luncheons and calling cards and opera. And you had the old money versus the new money. You know, the new money, they were far wealthier than the old money. Talk to me about that balance and how long it took to tip the balance so that the new money could outweigh the old money.
Yeah, I did not understand this until I started really digging into the research. But, you know, post-Civil War, you had the Knickerbockers, which were the old money. And these were people who were descendants of the original Dutch settlers of New York. And they were considered royalty. You know, Caroline Astor was a Knickerbocker. Then post-Civil War, you had families like the Vanderbilts, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers, the Morgans, who came into immense wealth due to whether it was the railroad industry or finance or whatever. And they were so eager to show off their goods. You know, they built these enormous mansions. They went and got Worth gowns. They went on shopping sprees in Paris. And the Knickerbockers thought that was really gaudy. You know, the Knickerbockers were actually very understated in the beginning. Caroline Astor had a massive home, but it was just a townhouse, a brownstone. And all of the Knickerbockers' homes looked exactly the same on the outside. And then you had Alva Vanderbilt that came along and built this petit chateau on Fifth Avenue. So they started kind of opening the Knickerbockers' eyes and saying, we're being upstaged by the new money, the nouveau riche. And it really became a matter of the tail wagging the dog, where suddenly you had the Knickerbockers trying to outspend and outshine the nouveau riche. And, you know, of course, society at that time, you know, Caroline's whole objective was to keep it just for the Knickerbockers. Her and her sidekick, the ultimate snob, Ward McAllister, they wanted to keep the new money out. So it set up a very interesting sort of two camps within society until they eventually sort of became one.
And, you know, just the sheer amount of money they were using to outspend each other. I mean, I think you had mentioned like there were $30,000 ball gowns and somebody's ball gown was actually double that. They were thinking to themselves. And, you know, Alva had $10,000 in petty cash. I mean,
yeah.
And this is, you know, what would $10,000 in petty cash equate to today?
You know, that would probably be about $250,000. And I'm making this calculation because there was a famous dog ball and Mamie Fish bought a $15,000 diamond collar for her dog for the ball. And by today's money, that would have been about $300,000. So I'm not great with math, but I think we're talking a lot of money.
So in your author's note, you distinguished, you know, any liberties you took with your characters' lives when it was more convenient to have somebody die the year before or when you would fill in gaps. Yeah. And I appreciated learning some of this after I had read the book, but I'm still shaking my head about the 400 list. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah. So Caroline Astor and her snooty sidekick, Ward McAllister, devised this list of 400 names. It was actually Ward McAllister that kind of led the charge on this. And it was stated that 400 people were the amount of people that could comfortably fit in Caroline Astor's ballroom. And Ward McAllister also went on to say that there's only 400 families that know how to conduct themselves in proper society. If you go outside that number, you get people that will make you uncomfortable, and they will be uncomfortable. So they drew up this list of 400 names, and much to Caroline's horror, Ward McAllister actually published it in the New York Times. And suddenly people were just mortified that they weren't on the list. And it was to the point where if Caroline was having a ball and you weren't invited because you weren't on that 400, you either took off or you sat in the dark in your home, because God forbid somebody should see that you, you know, didn't have a very good reason for not being at that ball. So it was all about exclusivity. And they used exclusion as a weapon.
You mentioned the $15,000 dog collar. What was the most outrageous thing you discovered that actually occurred during this time?
Oh my God, where do I begin? You know, fact is so much stranger than fiction. I could never have dreamed this stuff up. I think the biggest surprise to me came when I started researching about all the balls. Because I knew Mrs. Astor had her annual ball every year, but I had no idea how they would escalate over time. And, you know, I think it all got kicked off with Alva Vanderbilt's famous masquerade ball in 1883. that you had referenced earlier, where people were spending tens of thousands of dollars on their costumes that they're going to wear one time. And that was really her housewarming party for Petit Chateau, for her new home. But from there, hostesses began thinking, oh, well, we need a theme for our balls too. So they started doing the color balls. So there was the all white ball, the blanc ball, there was the red ball or the rouge ball, you know, and they just went through, you know, the Crayola crayons and used every color they could. And when they were done with that, the pendulum kind of swung the other way, and another couple said, well, we're going to throw a servant's ball, where they had all their guests went and got costumes made to represent like rags, you know, like they were either, you know, some, you know, floor sweeper or, you know, a laundress or something like that. But of course they were made of satin and silk. And the host greeted his guests with a feather duster in one hand and a mop in the other. The guests, they all played their roles to the hilt. They attempted to make their own supper that night. And, you know, after that, then came the animals. So, you know, somebody brought an elephant in for one of their balls. You know, we had talked about the dog ball, the chimpanzee ball. Mamie Fish threw a party for the mysterious Prince Del Drago of Corsica, and he turned out to be a chimpanzee. There was the horse ball at Sherry's, where they brought in hay and dirt and filled it. Sherry's was a very affluent restaurant in that time period. And all the guests showed up on horseback, and the saddlebags had bottles of champagne, and they would drink their champagne through a little tube. And I don't know what they did with the manure afterwards. You know, and then after that, after they'd run their course and there were no more animals to bring into the festivities, then the Bradley Martin Ball decided we need an elegant, good old fashioned masquerade ball. And it was held at the Waldorf. And I believe it was worth $10 million to throw by today's money. 1,500 guests. Each couple had their own footmen. Each couple had three bottles of champagne. The outfits were outlandish. And, you know, there was also a great financial crisis going on at this time. So there's a big backlash for this. And I think the Bradley Martin Ball kind of marked the end of these just outlandish, over-the-top entertainments.
And I do want to talk a little bit about a shift that happened in the book, because there was a point in the book, and I believe it was after the Metropolitan Opera House was completed, and some of the society women paused to take note of some of the things that Alva Vanderbilt was accomplishing. And she was, you know, kind of stepping outside of the traditional role of wife and mother. She still was being wife and mother, but she was adding on to that role. And the chorus said, quote, "It makes us take a breath and, for better or worse, re-examine our lives." At another point in the book, the society chorus said, quote, "These men, they underestimate us." So talk to me about, like, the distinct roles of men and women in society, but also like the double standards that were just accepted and how women started pushing back.
Yeah. So, you know, women really were at the mercy of their husbands and fathers. You know, if you were a woman during the Gilded Age, you were a wealthy woman during the Gilded Age, you were supposed to get married, make babies, and be a society hostess. And your husband could do whatever he wanted. You know, you were really his property. So he could go and have a string of mistresses. He could go visit the brothels. And you just looked the other way. You couldn't say anything. You couldn't turn him away at your bedroom door that night. And Alva Vanderbilt was one of the first women, when her husband started doing what all the other husbands were doing, she said, not on my watch. This is not happening. And she really pushed back against that. And, you know, I want to give away too many spoilers, but it's pretty common known knowledge, if you know anything about the Gilded Age, that, you know, she sued her husband for divorce, which was unheard of. And one of the things I admired the most about her was that she was constantly pushing the boundaries of what was believed acceptable for a woman. You know, she was not a licensed architect, but she certainly could have been. She spoke the language. She built Petit Chateau. She was involved in Marble House, which was her Newport summer cottage, her 50-room cottage. And, you know, she also, you know, later on in life became a suffragette, but she just never accepted the fact that she was inferior to a man simply because of her sex. And I think she was way ahead of her time in just having the courage to fight back for just some basic human decency. And so I admire her a lot for that. And I think other women sort of followed her lead.
You mentioned that she was a suffragette, and I wanted to ask about that because we just celebrated last year the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. And so you wrote about, you know, how some of the women got involved with the movement. But I wonder if the focus we were having celebrating the 100 years helped you focus at all on that section of the novel.
You know, Alva came to that a little bit later. So it's really towards the end of the book that she starts to get involved with that. So, you know, I don't know if it had a direct influence. I've always been interested in, you know, the suffrage movement and wondered what role I might have played in all that. You know, do you ever go back and think like, God, if I had been around in that time, would I have marched? Would I have, you know, would I have gone on a hunger strike? Would I have, you know, but I think that given Alva's childhood and all, it made perfect sense. You know, she came from this very wealthy Southern family, and then her family lost it all. And they went from being well-to-do to being pretty impoverished until she married into money with the Vanderbilts. And so she could kind of see both sides. You know, and this is more on the economic side, but I think she also felt that way for women. I don't think she necessarily separated the haves and the have-nots from just a financial standpoint. I think she also saw it as the women, as the haves and have-nots, you know, women versus men. So I think it was almost unnatural that she would have moved in that direction, especially because she had sort of reached the peak of society and looked around and said, there's got to be more to life than this. So I think she was just really curious and not easily satisfied with the status quo. She wanted more and more and more. She just sort of had an insatiable appetite for power, for control, and she found ways to go out and get that for herself.
Okay, so, you know, you brought attention to the have and the have-nots, and there were people protesting outside of the Bradley Martin Ball. So this wealth disparity was taking place more than 100 years ago, but it felt timely to me.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah, which is, you know, eye-opening and a little disheartening to say the least. But, you know, you look at like Silicon Valley and you look at, you know, the immense wealth of, you know, certain entrepreneurs and businesses. You look at, you know, what Amazon has done and you look at the people behind that and, you know, how much is enough, you know? And, you know, like during the pandemic, we had volunteered at a food pantry, and it was heartbreaking to see people who never in a million years thought that they would have to line up to get a box of food to feed their families. And I think there's just a tremendous divide in this country between the wealthy and those who are barely getting by paycheck to paycheck or no paycheck at all right now. So that felt very timely as I was writing it, and something I definitely wanted to include in the book, but not include it in a way that, you know, look at the parallels.
Yeah.
But the parallels are there.
You mentioned in the notes following the novel, which I discovered after writing my questions, that one of your greatest challenges was your cast of characters. How were you able to detect a pulse and discover their humanity?
Oh my God, this book was, I rewrote this book three times top to bottom, trying to figure out how to make these women relatable to readers today. Because on the surface, they were just wealthy, social climbing, superficial women who were obsessed with party going and clothes. And it wasn't until I began to think of Caroline Astor as the CEO of a major corporation, which was how she ran society, that I began to see sort of the inner workings of her mind and how she operated, and started to think of them as wives, as mothers, as daughters and sisters, you know. And not that either Caroline or Alva would have gotten Mother of the Year by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, the things that kept them up at night were their daughters and their wondering where their husbands were, and that there was a lot more to them after digging down through the layers and many, many drafts, that I began to see them as real women, as opposed to just these money-hungry, society ball-throwing, almost caricatures of themselves.
How many books of historical fiction have you published?
So this is number 6, and I'm just finishing up number 7.
And what draws you to the genre?
You know, I have always loved history. I just love things old. Like, if it were up to me, I would still be writing on a typewriter and it would be a manual typewriter. I just love old stuff like that. And I love finding out about a new time period and a new slice of history. And just like you said, it still relates to what we're going through today. You know, history definitely repeats itself. And I love to take on topics that I know very little about and then just dive into them, because I get to learn.
How do you determine the subject, and then how deep do you dive into the research?
Figuring out what the next topic is going to be, it takes a village. So it's usually me and my agent and my editor, and we kind of huddle, and I'll come up with a list, and, you know, then they'll say, "Nah, we've already got a book like that," or "Nah, I don't think there's enough there." And, you know, when we hit on it, we know. Like with the Social Graces, I knew we were onto something when my agent's email and my editor's email, they must have just crossed in cyberspace, and my agent said, "What about Consuelo Vanderbilt?" And like right the next email was my editor saying, "What about something in Gilded Age New York?" So I started doing some preliminary research, and I knew that there was a story there between Caroline Astor and Alva Vanderbilt. And in terms of how deep I'll go as deep as I possibly can. For example, when I did a book on the Chicago Blues, Birth of the Blues and the Civil Rights Movement, called Windy City Blues. And for that, I really did not know enough about the blues. So we went down to New Orleans, we drove the blues highway, we went to juke joints, we picked cotton, we went and talked to musicians. We became friendly actually with members of the Chess family of Chess Records. And they shared all kinds of stories with us about Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Chuck Berry. You know, I even tried to play the guitar. I tried to learn to play blues guitar. It was disastrous. Then I tried playing the harmonica, thinking that was a throwaway instrument, like the triangle. Yeah, no, really, really hard, probably harder than the guitar. But yeah, I'll read everything I can get my hands on. I'll watch documentaries and, you know, movies set in those time periods. In the case of the Social Graces, we went to Newport to see the mansions, the cottages. And, you know, you just cannot believe the opulence of these. They're breathtaking, you know, gold ceilings. I mean, it's not everybody's taste, granted, but, you know, I mean, it's just mind blowing. So, yeah, I try and get as close to a subject as I possibly can. If there's people I can talk to, I'll talk to them. I love the research. I mean, I can get lost in that forever. You know, the one thing that I hope that when readers, you know, get to the end of this book, that they have a little bit of a smile on their face, because we have been through such a rough time with this pandemic. And I really hope that readers will be able to escape into another time and place and forget their troubles for just a little while. That's what I hope.
That was Renee Rosen, author of the novel The Social Graces, which was published by Berkeley. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torrin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. And this episode was produced by Haley Krausen and me. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Goulet.